Where do clear mandates come from, and who can deliver one in this day and age? Thousands of no supporters took to the streets of Istanbul on Monday in response to Sunday's referendum that granted Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan more power. After promising a landslide, the Turkish president was able to only get a narrow margin victory, and the no supporters are a sign of how divided Turkey is. Secular and anti-Erdogan opposition was concentrated in cities like Istanbul and the capital of Ankara. And this pattern can be seen around the world. Angry rural voters, happy to drop political bombshells, and liberals in cities not anxious to just lurch the nation into an uncertain direction. Nearly 60% of Londoners, for instance, voted to remain in the European Union when asked to vote on Brexit last June. But the fact that the rural countervote made it a squeaker to get out of the European Union? Well, that's apparently why the UK's Theresa May wants to hold new elections. It's a surprise. She called for them today. Here in the U.S., an overwhelming amount of voters in big cities like New York City, Los Angeles, and San Francisco did not choose President Donald Trump as their candidate during the 2016 election, which may be why Donald Trump is stumping in the small towns of Wisconsin today, as we just heard. Ian Bremmer is president and founder of Eurasia Group. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Ian.
Hey, happy to be with you.
So you're looking at the election results around the world as a kind of competition between conservative rural, not elites, but voters, and liberal elites centered in cities. Is that a global phenomenon?
Well, I mean, it's certainly one of the more important dynamics, right? I mean, you saw that in the UK with the Brexit referendum. I mean, overwhelmingly in the city of London and in major urban centers doing very well economically, they were voting with the establishment. You get outside of those areas and you have people that really think that the way the world is going and globalization isn't for them. That's clearly the case in the US elections. That was clearly the case very starkly with the Turkish referendum over the weekend. And I think you're going to see this with the French elections coming up as well.
Is anger centered outside of cities? And does that mean instability is going to be pushed from outside cities? Because we associate protests and large protests and big protest movements with, you know, people on the street in cities.
Well, I think the answer is probably not so much in the early days, in the sense that you're talking about countries that are pretty wealthy. And so as a consequence, you know, they'll vote, but that doesn't mean you're going to get a lot of instability. You know, you had mass protests in the United States for a couple weekends, and where did that go now? It feels like the Occupy Wall Street movement. But generally speaking, I think that when this expands, right, when you start seeing this in major emerging markets, where right now the rural areas are still doing well because they're driving a lot of growth, but it's unlikely that's going to continue, then I think you see much more instability. So questions of state shaking instability really have much more to do with the comparative poverty of a lot of these countries.
Take a look at India, and let me know if this dynamic applies to India, because you've got a very strong leader who does attract an outside of the city's constituency, but he seems to be doing well in the cities as well.
First of all, India has been growing at a very significant clip even before Modi came into power, and he's been expanding that. So, I mean, in India, you're talking about a country where per capita income is very low. There's still an enormous amount of benefit to be gained from globalization. So the precise things that you see people protesting against in the United States, across the continent of Europe and the UK, and to a degree in the Gulf states in the Middle East, you do not see in a country like India, and you won't see for quite some time. So I actually see that Modi today is, and frankly, you see this in Southeast Asia more broadly, is one of the most strong and legitimized leaders of any country in the world today. But that has more to do with the structural aspects of India than perhaps it does with Modi, the individual leader.
Well, it's interesting to compare Modi and Erdogan in Turkey, because I think Modi certainly benefits from the structural things that you're talking about. Erdogan has managed to, you know, create this kind of, you know, constituency-driven dictatorship in Turkey, but the vote is so close. Does he need more of a mandate? Has he come to the end of his sort of voting majority and that he can't really go to the people anymore?
Well, First of all, I'd say it's hard to say that this is a legitimate election in the way that the Brexit referendum or the U.S. election was. You already saw that OSCE monitors saw some very deep concerns about the way the actual votes were compiled, and Erdogan wants none of it, says it's not relevant, keep your nose out of his business. Also, it certainly wasn't a fair election, you know, with tens of thousands of his opponents locked up following the failed coup attempt and the free media all but shut down. It's a little surprising, and I think it's quite surprising to him that he only got 51% of the vote. He really thought it was going to be 55-60. So you're absolutely right that this is really no mandate from a democratic and legitimacy perspective, but he just wants to win. And so he will now have the ability to, I think, extend the state of emergency. He'll now have the ability to continue to repress and gain more powers for himself. So in terms of, is Turkey now successfully being made into a soft authoritarian regime or dictatorship? I think the answer is yes, but I think that his ability to marshal large numbers of actual votes, we've already seen that's been degraded significantly.
So let's talk about the media here. The media covers cities fairly well and does a dreadful in rural areas. I'm wondering if the media tends to distort the outcomes or the expected outcomes by overrepresenting cities and underrepresenting rural areas.
I think it absolutely does. And this dynamic has been in play in France and in the UK, and I think here in the United States as well. The media is increasingly talking to itself. And it's also because the demographics have become so much more narrow. You know, you do better if you are more politicized, if you're telling people what they want to hear. If you treat your constituents as consumers as opposed to citizens, you'll make more money. Now, in the UK, you have the BBC, which can avoid that to a degree because they don't have to worry about funding, so they can cover everything. But, you know, in a country like the United States, where the media is very corporatized, it's really hard to justify putting together the kind of programming that would actually expand your viewership and readership beyond those cities. But you definitely get a bubble as a consequence. And I think people end up with surprises that and some of the polling methodologies that also have shown some structural bias when people are thinking about candidates that are completely non-establishment, so they don't necessarily tell the pollers. I think those are two reasons why you've seen so many surprises come out of the developed world recently.
Does that produce anxiety at number 10 Downing Street, for instance? I mean, does that help to explain why Theresa May has decided to go for this referendum? She's not convinced there's any mandate out there, and she's scared to move and all of a sudden reverses herself because she wants the voters to deliver something that I'm wondering if they can even deliver. It was so close the last time on Brexit.
I think it's nearly impossible for the voters to give a clear national mandate on an issue like this. I mean, there are reasons to think that you might want supermajorities as opposed to simple majorities when society is so divided. If you want to make a change that is that structural, that's going to affect that many people for generations. On the other hand, that also implies that the establishment gets to control everything. And if things are seriously broken, the hurdles to fixing them actually become that much greater. This is a true conundrum for leaders of developed states.
Ian Bremmer, president and founder of Eurasia Group. Thanks so much, Ian.
And always a pleasure.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.